everyone. This is the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. As usually, it is with Stefan, which is me. I am an author for the Tower of the Hand homepage, and I have my own blog, The Nerdstream Era. And with me is, as always,
Sean T. Collins. I am the creator and host of All Leather Must Be Boiled at BoiledLeather.com, which is my very special A Song of Ice and Fire Game of Thrones Tumblr. I also cover Game of Thrones and many other television shows and other things for RollingStone.com. And I co-authored the annotated A Game of Thrones for the Subtext iPad app with Elio Garcia and Anne Grohl. And Stefan and I have reunited once again because George R.R. Martin has published another chapter from The Winds of Winter once again. And this one, I think at first glance to a lot of people, did not appear as dense or as meaty as the previous preview chapter that he had published at the exact same URL on his own website, which, of course, was about Theon. This one is about Arianne. And, you know, since it doesn't touch on the Pink Letter and it doesn't touch on the Battle of Ice and all the goings-on with the Boltons and the Night's Watch and all those things, it seems a little, you know, like there's somewhat less going on. But I think that as Stefan and I both reread the chapter and took some notes in anticipation of this podcast, we discovered that there actually is quite a bit to talk about. So, Stefan, would you like to get the ball rolling?
Oh, yeah. It is true. The first time I read this chapter, I also thought, yeah, well, it was nice to see Arianne again, you know, but there didn't seem to be really something in it, besides that we now know what Orion Waters is doing. Mm. But on rereading it, there were some things that gave me pause, to say the least. It might be that we will start overinterpreting soon, but that's always the danger with this stuff. So we found several points that really were interesting because they connect to theories that are out there, not only theories that we developed, but that are really vibrant within the fandom. So for the Great Maester Conspiracy, for example, you have another dot to connect in this chapter. We get a mention of the Krakens. We get mentions of John Connington and his disease in very cryptic form, more or less. And we get a very ominous dream about dragons that leaves some questions. So that is just stuff that is in the background that may mean something. It doesn't need to. Of course, we will discuss what it could be. And then there are some things in the foreground in the official structure, so to say, that are also pretty interesting to look at. I think, for example, the Band of Seven, with which Arianne is traveling, is composed quite interestingly with Damon Sand and Joss Hood and all these guys we never heard about. And these are topics we want to tackle today.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if we should start with something meaty or something silly. I think I'm going to go with silly and talk about the Krakens, because I'm a big fan of sea monsters, giant squid, anything of that nature. It's just something that, since I was a little kid obsessed with the Loch Ness Monster, has really just sort of fired my imagination. And of course, you know, a few books back when I think it was Cersei received a report of both the dragons, which are real, and the Krakens, which, you know, that's up for debate. You know, I was excited, but then, you know, upon rereading, it seems like, well, maybe this is just sort of a garbled transmission about the Ironborn and the range of Victarion and Euron's forces, you know, which is basically unprecedented and certainly in living memory for the Ironborn. So maybe, you know, by Krakens, they really just meant, you know, the Greyjoy forces and the Greyjoy fleets and things like that. But this is a lot tougher to dismiss as a sort of game of telephone where someone was attacked by the Ironborn. And, you know, because they're talking about, like, the specific behavior of these animals. You know, they're drawn to the surface by blood, and they're breaking ships and, or, you know, pulling wrecks down or whatever it is that they say. Which is very, very exciting to me, because I just want to see someone fight a Kraken, for Pete's sake, you know? It's like the ice spiders that are mentioned often in tandem with the others. Like, don't bring that in. You know, it's like, I always joke, you know, I think it was Anton Chekhov who said, you know, one should not put an ice spider on stage if one has no intention of you know, an ice demon riding it into battle. And that's kind of how I feel about these Krakens, that I, at this point, I'm a little bit more confident that we are going to see a giant squid eat some people, which I'm quite pleased about.
Yeah, it might be, as long as it is not in Pirates of the Caribbean style.
Right.
But I'm not entirely sure. I would, if I had to place some money on a bet whether we would see an actual Kraken devouring a ship or something, I would say we won't. It seems more like a passing mention, like the Snarks and Grumpkins that are all the time mentioned. And if we see them, I think I would stay corrected. I don't really think we will see the Krakens. I think they are more or less a throwaway line, something that people are talking about, like when Cersei and others dismiss reports about it with, they talk about mermaids all the time too. I think it really is more or less a story. Although, of course, I would like to see a battle against Kraken, especially one that eats Victorian Greyjoy.
That would be great.
That would be poetic justice.
You are the Scully to my Mulder. See, I want to believe, Stefan, and you're the skeptic here. So this will be fun seeing how this plays out. I'm remembering this day and this conversation.
Yeah, we should make a poster of it, a giant squid, and I want to believe.
If any enterprising listeners out there have any Photoshop skills and can make a poster for me of that, I would be greatly appreciative. I guess we could flip over to something a little more substantial, although it's kind of in the same realm of, you know, magic and the degree to which it is or isn't influencing the real world. And that is the little snippet we get of Teora Toland. You know, a quiet, red-haired girl, a little more heavy-set than her older sister, apparently, and less glamorous and shy, not interested in boys, who sort of out of the blue during Arianne's dinner with this house that's hosting her, says that she is confident that dragons are coming because she's seen them in dreams, and the dragons were dancing, and everywhere they danced, people died. And this, of course, is dismissed by her family as just, you know, a result of an overactive imagination and dreams brought on by, you know, eating poorly before bedtime. And, you know, they say, what's the maester's name? Maester Tommen. And, you know, Maester Tommen says, and Teora says, "I hate Maester Tommen," and storms away from the table. So if you believe Marwyn the Mage and his contention that the maesters are sort of systematically biased against magic, even to the extent of actively working to sabotage and destroy magic that it's in their power to sabotage and destroy, this gives, you know, some credence to that. I mean, we've already seen, you know, in Winterfell, a maester who is a skeptic or a rationalist and is reluctant to believe Bran's stories about his dreams and things like that. But, you know, at this point in the narrative, seeing that take place takes on a sort of more conspiratorial and sinister air than it did at the beginning when you just thought, like, oh, you know, this guy just doesn't believe that that's the case because he's, you know, he's a man of science. Now we're learning that there may be more to it than that, and then that makes this one little, "I hate Maester Aemon," Teora said, and then she bolted from the table. That makes it a lot more intriguing than it might have been, you know, five books earlier.
Yeah, I think there is some meat to this Maester conspiracy theory, just in the regard that they are, of course, opposed to magic, because after all, they are representatives of learning, of academics and of science, and as such, they can't really love magic or harbor any love towards magic, and of course, they will always try to find a reasonable explanation for anything like visions or stuff. We have seen it with Maester Luwin and Bran multiple times.
Right.
And Bran is a rather nice boy, and we don't know much about the Toland girl, but if she is a little bit more hot-headed, so to speak, and the Dornish oftentimes are, then of course she will harbor some hatred towards the maester for disillusioning her all the time and not taking her seriously. But I also think that there will be maesters actively working against it. The question for this theory is whether the Citadel as an institution and the maesters as representatives of this institution are in a great conspiracy, are in league together, or if there are just some guys who have made up their own exclusive club.
Right.
And are fighting against magic, the opponents that Marvin the Mage spoke of.
Yeah, I mean, we've discussed this, I think, before, and you know, it comes up with real-life conspiracy theories, which is, you know, the bigger the goal of the conspiracy gets, you know, in theory, the more people are involved, and it just becomes difficult to believe that that many people can keep a secret, right? Because there's so many of them, and they have different loyalties and different degrees of skill at subterfuge, and eventually someone's going to slip. So the question becomes, how many maesters are actively involved in actively suppressing magic, trying to kill dragons, things of that nature? And how many is it just, you know, just sort of how they were taught at the Citadel not to buy this stuff? And in a situation like this, I do wonder, you know, and this, we're just, I'm basically just making things up, but it could it be a possibility that, you know, maesters either take it upon themselves or are encouraged, if they are seeing evidence of magic, to report back to the Citadel, like, hey, you know, this kid is having visions, should I do anything? And then getting instructions from the Citadel about what to do. Or is it just a case of another Maester Lewin type who has trained not to really believe in this stuff and so dismisses it, you know, as a kid's overactive imagination, and therefore is resented by the kid who knows that it's very real. So, yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we don't really get shed a new light on this theory in this chapter. It is more, if you believe in the theory, this will give you just another hint at its at its existence now.
Right.
And if you don't believe in it, yeah, well, it is just a throwaway comment.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to wait and see until we get to Maester Marvin again.
Right.
Because he will provide us with way more information the next time we see him. I'm sure of it.
Right. Now, what I also... I'm sorry, go ahead.
That was it.
Oh, I also wonder, with regards to Tior Tolan in particular, are we going to see any more from this character? Or is it just like a one-off thing to demonstrate that, like, magic is starting to pop up all over the place? Because I kind of... it feels to me like it'll be that latter tactic, and I think that's pretty cool. And it's nice to see some of it in Westeros. You know, we've obviously seen, you know, in Daenerys's adventures throughout Essos, that, you know, like the one that comes to mind is when she was in the marketplace and saw the you know, the guy climbed the ladder of fire and then disappear, which is something that he couldn't do, you know, just several weeks earlier. And all of a sudden he developed that power because ostensibly because of the rebirth of the dragons. Well, are there similar little one-off cases of magic going on in Westeros? And I like that kind of thing. I find that intriguing as a literary device, like, you know, with regards to Patchface, for example. I kind of like the idea that if there's never anything more to Patchface beyond a really creepy, mentally impaired fool who every once in a blue moon says something genuinely prophetic but doesn't know it and no one knows it, I think that's really evocative and eerie. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with him having one line of genuine prophecy about the Red Wedding, and that's it. And I would kind of dig it if we start seeing these little, you know, pop-up explosions of magic into the real world that then kind of subside. But I don't know. I don't know what it'll be.
I like it too as a storytelling device,
yeah.
That's for sure, simply because it doesn't intrude on us like it does in many fantasy stories. It is just small flickers. You can ignore them if you like, you can dig into them, but they don't really affect the overall story, which is still centered around the characters. Because every time you introduce magic to your story, you have this, this danger of getting in that you are forgetting your characters because you raise the stakes so high with magic and prophecy and foreboding and stuff like that. And I really hope that Martin will avoid this trap, and I'm confident that he will.
Yeah.
So I can enjoy these little drops and hold my hopes up.
Agreed.
That they will remain little drops.
Right, right. also a little bit meatier, and tying back to the events of the previous two books. We don't even really... I'm trying to think. We don't... The only new information we get about Ariane's co-conspirators, one of whom is a traitor, is that Greenstone, where Spotted Silva has been essentially exiled within her own country to marry an old man and live out her days in sort of a dreary condition, has been conquered, supposedly conquered by John Connington and the Golden Company. That's really the only new information we get about them. But it's made me think, again, and this is something I think I've suggested on my blog, that Silva is the traitor, because the other two possibilities, Dre and Garen, were exiled out of the country. And I know that it's not such a great fortune to be married off to an old man and live in apparently the single dreariest castle in all of Westeros, Green Shit, as Jaime dubbed it. But, you know, she's still in Dorne. She is married to a guy who, in all likelihood, will probably die soon. So it's not a life sentence. And it's not that Green Shit will be some great prize for her to inherit, but it's better than nothing. And just more to the point, in terms of storytelling, she's the only one who we're likely to see again, right? Because she is now in the path of the story. She, you know, that castle has been taken by John Connington, and she's still around for Arianne to potentially meet up with. Whereas, you know, unless we've been lied to about Dre and Garen, we're not going to see them again, most likely. So that makes me feel that she's most likely to be the traitor. And I was wondering what your thoughts on that group were.
I think the most convincing argument you just brought up is the likelihood of seeing her again.
Right.
Because Dre was sent to Norwos and Garen was exiled to Tyrosh, so it is very much likely that we won't see both of them again. But Spotted Silva is still around, and the traitor is, while it is not of a real importance for the overall story, for Arianne herself and her personal character arc, it certainly is a very important discovery to know who the traitor was.
Mm-hmm.
And the chance of seeing her again, of course, helps facilitate this theory. To quote Chekhov again, you don't talk about the traitor if you don't want to uncover him. So I guess that makes it most likely just from a narrative standpoint.
Right.
And right. Given the lack of information we have, it is our best guess.
Yeah. Now, I guess this is the fourth possibility is the Dark Star, but Doran would really have to have been playing some 12-dimensional chess for me to figure out what possible advantage. If Dark Star was working with Doran and betrayed this mission to Doran, then why would he have attacked Myrcella with the intention of killing her? You know, it's just hard to figure out. And I think you had some... Did you have any thoughts on Darkstar?
Basically? Yeah, that was the next thing I wanted to bring up, because Darkstar, I didn't like the character at all when I first read Feast for Crows,
mm-hmm.
and my predicament toward him hasn't really changed that much. But he's consistent in fandom as a minor character, and there are some theories evolving around him. I read only days ago that he might be Aegon Targaryen, and this might be Doran's game, and there was even cited some quote-unquote evidence from the text on it, and I thought, what the hell?
Yeah.
And there are really three quotes about Darkstar that I singled out to be interesting. Two of this new chapter, and the other one is from Feast for Crows. The Feast for Crows perhaps at first, because someone says, I don't know if it was Doran or Arianne, that he is the most dangerous man in Dorne. And this is the key evidence piece for the aforementioned conspiracy theory, because why is Darkstar the most dangerous man? I think the answer is pretty easy, because he is the guy who starts a war,
mm-hmm.
and who is mad enough to do so.
Right.
And we have two quotes in the new chapter supporting this reading, because Arianne says, it is Daemon Sand who says, he's no man and he's more of a viper than Oberyn. which is a compliment in and of itself. And Arian thinks he's poison. And that is just true. You had your line in your notes about dark and dangerous men. Mm-hmm. And it is simply true. This guy is dangerous, definitely. He is good looking and dark, and so he appeals to young girls like Arian is. And his own ends are, I think, not primarily political in a sense that he wants to gain power or riches or something, but he wants to wage war. He wants to fight. He wants a good fight. And obviously, Doran Martell is not going to give it to him. And so he does what he needs to do in allying with Arian to get his fight. And that's why he attacks Myrcella, which I think was his plan all along.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the line from The Dark Knight, which is not my favorite movie, but it has some nice moments, particularly with regards to the Joker and Alfred's description. You know, some men just want to watch the world burn. And, you know, I think that people reacted negatively towards the Dark Star because he seemed like such a conscious effort to create a badass. And the more we learn about him, the more we learn that, well, yes, that's true. But not just on George R. R. Martin's part, but on the Dark Star's part as well. Like, he is very consciously cultivating this air of glamorous darkness and danger and death. And it's an interesting contrast with the other Danes that we've either actually met or had described to us, you know, Arthur and Ashara and little Ned, you know, are a very different breed. And as Elio Garcia, you know, has detailed extensively in discussing Dawn, the Sword of the Morning, how that's an office that's not hereditary, how the sword and that title are only given to Danes of extraordinary worth. You know, it's a very interesting and odd and old family, and Darkstar really sticks out like a sore thumb, both within the narrative and then, you know, relative to the other members of that family that we've met. And it's clearly was cultivated deliberately by him, and it served him very well. You know, he got in the good graces of the Princess of Dorne and participated in this very key conspiracy and could have literally single-handedly started a war. If he had successfully killed Myrcella, and may have well done so anyway, simply by maiming her the way he did. You know, I think we're all curious to see if it does go beyond, you know, what you and I describe as his simple sort of, you know, desire to cause trouble. You know, and we don't really know. I do think it's funny, and I mentioned this in my notes, I think.
Yeah,
that line, absolutely. You know, pretty boys had ever been her weakness, particularly the ones who were dark and dangerous as well. If I described a character and gave her that motivations on Tumblr, I would get reblogged with nasty notes and stuff, which I think is really funny. Like, I was just, you know, if you dare give, I guess particularly a woman, if you ascribe those such frivolous motives to her in terms of her behavior, you're going to hear about it. You know, and I think that's fine, and it's good to have a corrective against dismissing the motives of female characters as being, you know, girly nonsense. But in this particular case, Arianne has a healthy dose of nonsense to her in terms of how she behaves and how she acts, and she's, you know, she's learning about that, and she's kind of repentant and feels guilty about it. You know, you also see it in her description of her relationship with Aerys Okart, and how, you know, she misses him really badly, and is kind of surprised about that and regrets her conduct towards him. You know, what she feels literally drove him to suicide. That's a heavy weight to bear. And I think what we're seeing, you know, when her conspiracy failed, when she was so wrong about the Dark Star, when she, you know, had no idea what she was capable of driving Aerys to do, when she was so wrong about her father and what her father was up to all these years, when she learned that all the resentment she had towards her brother was basically for nothing. That's a lot of changes to go through in a very rapid succession. And I think Arianne's growth has been really impressive. Now we'll see where that heads, and that's something else I'm sure we're about to discuss. But, you know, I just thought it was funny seeing her, you know, within her own mind, lay bare her own shortcomings, you know, in such a blunt fashion that she's like, hey, she loves pretty boys. She loves bad boys. the nice guys of Westeros would have a real problem with Arianne.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we are going into discussing her and her character growth and Doran Martell and his plans and stuff, I would suggest that we take a quick look at her band of seven that Doran sent with her, because it seems like an interesting choice, the people he sent with her. There is Daemon Sand, her former lover, which I'm sure her father knows, who was Oberyn's squire, for Christ's sakes. Mm. We have two young knights that are totally unknown. We have this guy for the Ravens who doesn't seem to be a maester that they call Feathers. We have a generic lady companion, Shane Ladybride. And then we have what I find most odd, Lady Lance, this 14-year-old daughter of Oberyn, who all the time wants to joust and doesn't fit into the lady concept at all. That's my greatest question mark upon this band. Why does Doran Martell send this woman deliberately with Arianne on a diplomatic mission? What is her job? What is she intended to do?
That one is a big mystery to me, and it's only hearing you bring it up that I'm like, wow, I have no idea. You know, at first I was so fixated on Daemon and what he was doing there, because, you know, Arianne, you know, pretty much asked that question herself and has no answer to it. You know, of all the knights in Dorne, why did my father choose this one to be my shield? He knows our history. And I think the first two times I read the chapter, I wrote that down, you know. Why choose Daemon? Why indeed? I just left it a question mark. I wasn't sure. And this time around, right before we started doing this podcast, I, you know, reread it. And it was, I think it was like the very last or second to last paragraph that it kind of all clicked for me. Because people had brought up, you know, in comments on my Tumblr and here and there throughout the fandom, you know, does this chapter augur for Arianne involving herself in this coming conflict on the side of Aegon, you know, with the intention, perhaps, of positioning herself favorably versus her brother and her brother's, you know, shot at becoming king of the Seven Kingdoms via a marriage with Daenerys, which we know is not going to happen, obviously, but they don't know that. You know, because she does talk, you know, they has this whole long digression about her feelings about Quentin being, you know, kind of a doofus and all this business about, you know, what is Viserys like and how did Daenerys feel about it and why did she kill him, and all those things happen at once. So it seems like we're kind of hinting at a resentment to her brother that lingers, despite the fact that now she knows her dad wasn't trying to replace her as the heir to Dorne. You know, he was trying to set up this other thing as an alliance with the Targaryens for vengeance. So people are like, well, maybe she'll get on Aegon's side and wage war against, you know, Daenerys and all those kinds of things. And so then I finally figured it out. Why did Doran send her former lover with her to become her not-so-former lover, to get her laid and get her romantically entangled and keep her from getting involved with Aegon? That's my theory, at least.
Yeah, that's quite possible. And it is also a very ironic twist, because now with Quentin dead, of course, her marrying Aegon would be a great step toward in that plan. Right. But Doran couldn't know that.
Right.
So he prevents something that, of course, when he gets the information, would perhaps want to do. So there's just a little irony here. And I think your theory is interesting. The Daemon Sand is there to lay her and to keep her occupied, so to speak. Although, I would question whether this could work, actually, because Arianne doesn't seem the type who would try to get married to Aegon just to get laid once again.
Yeah.
I think if she wants to do that, she wants to do it for the political havoc it would wreak. And she doesn't, and it doesn't really play into here whether she gets laid or not.
Right.
Though your theory might still work, because Daemon Sand could all the while be there just to prevent that, to be a voice of reason. You know, I mean, just his existence, his lingering around, constantly remembers her, reminds her of the follies of her youth. I mean, obviously she slept with him, and he tried to propose when they were both young, and he is a vivid reminder of her youth. And that is exactly what she tries to leave behind, and what Doran has an interest in leaving behind. So it could be a kind, a part of a sick mind game that Doran is playing here. Perhaps that comes just to me. This is the reason why he sends Ilya Sand with her, because she too is this youthful fool in the end. She is doing stuff and saying stuff that is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And Arianne is noticing this more and more, and she's annoyed with it. And perhaps this is just a reminder of Doran how she shouldn't behave anymore.
That's brilliant, man. I was going to ask if you had it figured out, and I think you did. That makes as much sense as anything that I've heard.
Yeah, but I just made this up on the fly, so I wouldn't have it figured out if you had asked before. But it sounds better the more I think about it.
Wow, you're right. You're absolutely right. Wow, that's a great, you know, and I think it's worth noting that in both these cases, if the argument is not quite ironclad and indisputable, well, that's because human behavior isn't ironclad and indisputable, and Doran's, you know, trying his best. With the tools that he has at his disposal. So, you know, it's obviously not a perfect plan. You know, if Arianne is bound and determined to forge a marriage license, a marriage alliance with Aegon, and, you know, claim Westeros for herself while her brother is away with Daenerys, you know, having a guy she used to be interested in and used to date around, and having this young whippersnapper little girl to show how, you know, to sort of demonstrate on a daily basis what immaturity is like, to help force Arianne to be more mature. You know, none of that's going to stand in her way, but it couldn't hurt. And, you know, and Doran, who's obviously a student of the human condition and very patient and very subtle, as they keep saying, you know, he's trying his best.
Yeah, absolutely. I also stumbled upon one quote from Arianne in this chapter. When she thinks about John Connington and how she would face him, she has this thought. It's two thoughts, to be precise. She ponders the idea that he played dead for such a long time. And then she thinks, this requires a patience that is much like her father's. And this thought makes her uneasy. So at least she has grown up in that respect. She can now appreciate the patience of Doran Martell, and she knows how hard it is and how dangerous it is. And facing John Connington is, for her, a bit like facing her father, just without the bonus of being the daughter.
Yeah.
So it is a good sign for her maturity that she recognizes the danger in which she is stepping, and that she can assert the threat before her. It is not that this guy has elephants or the Golden Company, or that he has previously wanted to fuck Rhaegar Targaryen or something like that. No, it is that he is patient, and he is, just because of this little detail, a dangerous man. And that points toward a real growth on the page of Arianne. And the other thing is, after she has recognized this, she thinks, can I match such a man with words alone? And this is also very self-conscious, because up to that point, all she did was use her womanly charms to get the better of men and her station, of course. And both won't help her much with John Connington. So now she has to rely on her abilities, on her strength of character, if there is any. And she knows that this will be the first time, and she knows it will be a real test to her abilities. She's very conscious of what lays before her. And I think these two things really point towards her growth as a character.
Yeah, and I can't also help but wonder, as we sort of analyze, you know, what Doran's secret motivation is for including the various people in this party might be, with regards to John Connington and, you know, his unseducibility, you have to wonder, does Doran know about this? I mean, because as we've learned, Doran is no dummy. Doran knows people. Doran knew his brother, who's a difficult guy to know. So presumably, depending on the amount of exposure Doran had to Rhaegar and Rhaegar's circle, Doran may know that Arianne's old methods are not going to get her anywhere with John Connington, you know, for whatever reason. So sending her in the party, you know, forget all the other people he sent with her, even just sending her may have sort of a sort of hidden motivation of forcing Arianne to, you know, do her thinking and her plotting and her, you know, acting on behalf of Doran with her brain, because that's all she has. In terms of how she can treat with John Connington. And I do wonder, you know, because it's funny reading her and Daemon talk about John Connington and like, nope, no whores that I know of. I wonder what's going on there, you know, because we know what's going on there. He's gay, but they don't. But maybe Doran does.
Yeah, that's quite possible. Also, as you sketch out your thoughts like this, it comes to me that Arianne, in her situation, is very much comparable to Cersei. If you think back to the Siege of King's Landing, back in Clash of Kings, when she tells Sansa that every other man she would try to seduce with her womanly powers, but this is Stannis, and so she can't forget about this. And this is exactly the situation for Arianne before her conspiracy blew in her face, because all she did was, exactly like Cersei, use her station and her womanly charms to get what she wanted, and she never really had to think things through. She obviously has mental capabilities. She can think if she wants, but she didn't really need to, and Doran is now more or less forcing her. And that is why Arianne, who is, I don't know, two-thirds of Cersei's age, is already matured much farther than Cersei was, at least before the Walk of Shame.
Right.
And I think that is an interesting point, because Doran here tries to prevent exactly what happened in King's Landing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, you know, because I think I've talked... I can't really exactly remember, but it, given the people surrounding Cersei, you know, I can sort of understand why she reacted to things the way that she did. And it goes to show you something that I bring up all the time with these books, which is that who you are depends so much on the feedback you're getting from the people close to you. And Arianne is now at a point, you know, because of all these sort of simultaneous traumas that we just discussed, that she's receptive to feedback. And if Doran is steering her in the right way, I think that'll be really good for her. And it has nothing to do with him being a man and her being a woman, or him being the parent and her being the child. It just has to be with, you know, what are the rewards you're getting for your behavior, and what are the punishments you're getting for the behavior, and who are they coming from? And, you know, you. I already feel like we're seeing a different Arianne. Although, as you know, we've alluded, it's unclear in the future whether, you know, those changes will stick, or whether she will do something sort of rash, or with her own good fortune in mind, and cause as much trouble, if not more, than she had already caused. So, it's an interesting question.
Yeah, I have 2.5 points left over. The one is the whole Martell's strategy thing, because as you mentioned already, she thinks about Quentin a lot of the time, and she thinks of him as a rather dull person, not exactly that clever. And I think the most the most conspicuous line about it is, King Quentin, why does that sound so silly?
Yeah.
And after having read A Dance with Dragons, I know exactly why it does sound so silly, because it is simply a silly notion. Having seen Quentin in action, I have no doubt that he is a very decent guy, not exactly much fun to have around, but it doesn't hurt either. But imagining him as a king and the husband to Daenerys Targaryen and the Dragon Rider is really a strange thing.
Right.
And the fact that it falls so hard on Arianne to think about him that way, even after all the growing up and maturing she had and being part of her father's plans now, and still she can't imagine him like his father does. I think in that particular point, she really sees more clearly than Doran Martell does.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? I mean, let me ask you this. How do you feel the Martell prospects are for whatever is about to happen?
That's very, very hard to decide. Because the problem of the Martell case is that when we want to judge their prospects, we have to take two things in account. The first is the strategic situation, as we know, it is laid down. So we have Daenerys. She has 1 to 3 dragons. I'm hopeful that we will know in 2014. And she has obviously some troops at her disposal. So the moment that she arrives in Westeros, she will make a real impact. And we have no clue at all about how she will make that impact, and that was the point that I wanted to discuss a little bit further. And the second thing is that in Westeros itself, we have several warring factions. We have a civil war to break out in King's Landing between Lannister and Tyrell. We have the maybe false Aegon landing in the Rainwood and on Cape Wrath. We have chaos in the north and Stannis Baratheon, and that all adds up to one thing. The Martells simply don't have enough information. They don't know what is going on. And Doran Martell is clever enough to recognize this, and so he sends Arianne Martell strictly on a reconnaissance mission, which once again underlines his cautious nature.
Right.
And it is, I can't stress this enough, it is really a very clever move to do nothing in this situation. And just to watch how it will all play out.
Yeah.
So right of now, I simply can't say anything about the Martell prospects because we don't know what they intend to do. They take their seat in a small council. I think some Sand, daughter of Oberyn, was sent there, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I can't remember which one, though.
The Elaria?
No,
I don't know. It was the Scepter who always runs around in white, but I forgot your name too.
Yeah.
And so he plays it safe with the Lannisters. He has his army in the passes through the Dornish Mountains, but they don't do anything. They just sit there and wait, which is probably what Robb Stark also could have done back in the day. And Doran Martell simply does that. He makes contact with John Connington, but mainly to assert about how it's going on there. And he, of course, hasn't dismissed Daenerys Targaryen. So I think to decide what the prospects of Martell are, we need to know what they're up to. And I doubt that Doran knows it at this particular point.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of difficult thing for both the rulers in the books and the readers of the books, is that there are so many factors in play at this point that, I mean, who knows? Like, even something as silly as the Kraken thing, like, well, it matters if it's giant monsters or if it's Greyjoys, you know what I mean? Like, that tells you different things about the geopolitical fortunes of various factions or the influence of magic. And depending on which it is, you know, that makes a difference. And we have no idea. Nobody has any idea. So, yeah, it is really difficult to adjudicate. Also, I just think in terms of the books as literature, I don't know what we are supposed to feel about House Martell and Dorne. You know, I mean, I think it's relatively clear how we're supposed to feel about the Greyjoys, the Starks, the Lannisters, the Baratheon brothers, Daenerys. And that doesn't mean we know what their fate is going to be. You know, on the contrary, you know, we have no idea. Because sometimes Martin goes for poetic justice, and sometimes he goes for dramatic irony. And, you know, so we really don't know. But it's difficult to know even how to feel about the Martells. You know, they're... It's a large family. They played a relatively minor role until all of a sudden they became a big deal in the last couple of books. And all of them have a great deal of agency, much more so than other families where it's more or less a united front. You know, because of who Prince Oberyn was and because of who his daughters are, there's such a wide range of personalities and goals and tactics that it's just hard to know how to feel about them as a group. And so it's just hard to sense where things might be headed for them, I find. It's just,
I definitely agree with that. The thing that unsettles me about the Martells is this motivation of Doran's, because he expressly states that his main motivation is, and his heart's desire is vengeance.
Right.
So he isn't in this war to defend an ancient right, to avenge, to make something right, to free someone, or something like that. He simply wants blood. He's out for the blood, and this is nothing I can really stand behind, you know, even for a literacy figure. It is a motivation that I found unsettling to some point. And while it matches, after all we know, the disposition and the mentality of the Dornish men, so it is not like he would force them into the fight. They almost force him, because they are also with this blood and revenge and vendetta. This seems to be in their culture.
Right.
But this is nothing that I can endorse, so to speak, and that is why I have to admire the brilliance and the tactical patience of Doran Martell, but I can't really wish him a success in it. I think wherever the Martells will make their impact, it will be a very, very bloody one.
Yeah, and there was an essay in Beyond the Wall, and now I'm not going to be able to remember who wrote it, whoever it was, there was an episode of a podcast of Ice and Fire in which she was interviewed, and she made the argument that the one sort of moral through line in terms of ways that you can predict morality will affect the outcome of character stories within the books is that the people who are out for blood rather than the common good will ultimately pay for it. So that does make me lean towards the notion that things aren't going to go so well for Doran in the long run, but it's difficult to bring myself to say that, because Doran is really well justified, particularly in the sort of harsh eye for an eye medieval fantasy world that this is, in his quest for vengeance. Because, you know, what the Lannisters and Gregor Clegane did is really repulsive, and, you know, one of the worst atrocities in the entire series. So it's hard to say, well, you know, hey man, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword, Prince Doran, because, you know, he's out for justice in a sense, but the way he's going to play justice is revenge, fire and blood, and that's usually not good for anybody.
Especially since he doesn't seem to be out only for the blood of the direct perpetrators. I mean, Gregor Clegane is dead, Tywin Lannister is dead, Armory Lorch is dead. So,
Robert is dead.
Whom exactly is this revenge directed now?
Right. People who have,
It is more the idea of Lannister power. And if you want to destroy Lannister power, you are out for a lot of blood.
Yeah.
And that is strange in a way.
Yeah. Agreed. You know, before we get too far afield, I want to take things back to John Connington a little bit, if I may. Because there are two things I wanted to bring up about him. One is that I really like the wording of his letter. I thought it was just a lovely bit of writing and very persuasive. You know, to Prince Doran of House Martell, you will remember me, I pray. I knew your sister well and was a leal servant of your good brother. I grieve for them as you do. I did not die, no more than did your sister's son. To save his life, we kept him hidden, but the time for hiding is done. A dragon has returned to Westeros to claim his birthright and seek vengeance for his father and for the Princess Ilya, his mother. In her name I turn to Dorne. Do not forsake us. John Connington, Lord of blah, blah, blah. I think it's a, you know, particularly compared to the pink letter. Maybe we call this the red letter. I don't know. But, you know, it's just, it's like, it's well-worded. It's a little bit poetic. It has these little reveals. I did not die. It's just a great, you know, I mean, it's a paradox just saying I did not die. Well, of course you didn't. You're the one telling us you did not die. Obviously you're not dead. No more than did your sister's son, which would have been a big revelation, obviously, to Doran. To save his life, you know, just the way the clauses are placed. It's just an impressive little bit of writing. And, you know, so you can, it's the kind of thing where, does it matter that it's well-written in the long run? No, probably not. But you just get a sort of an emotional sense of why this letter would send things into turmoil and, you know, force Doran's hand to a certain extent. Because it has an emotional impact above and beyond the content of the letter.
Yeah, absolutely. I also thought when I read this letter that it was poetic, and as you just read it, it almost seems to rhyme at some point.
Yes, yes.
It is not flattering in any case. That wouldn't have been Connington's nature, but it also isn't gruff or something. So I think the wording he displays here is correct, simply. He knows what he's aiming for, and he chooses his words with care, and he knows how to choose his words.
Right. Now,
besides that, I very much look forward to his meeting Arianne, because I think John Connington is an interesting character, of course, and he is much alike to Doran Martell in many respects, I think. Not just a patient, but he is also out for vengeance, and of course he is also sick with a deadly and potentially crippling disease.
Right. I mean, the time for hiding is done, he says, and what we know, and he knows, but no one else does, is the reason he is going along with Aegon's desire to go full speed ahead is because he doesn't have the time to do anything else. He wants to make this happen before he dies, and that's the only way he can do it. So, you know, there's a contrast right there, despite their similarities of, you know, having this sort of long game patience, both Doran and John Connington, which Arianne remarks about, you know, in her thoughts about the two men. He's not going to have any patience anymore. And that's kind of a curveball to throw at Arianne that no one will be able to see coming because no one really knows the true cause. And of course, you know, when I thought about, oh, wow, you know, Doran sending Arianne to meet John Connington, Doran sending Arianne to meet someone who could be like patient zero in, you know, an apocalyptic plague.
Yes.
So, you know, that's really striking too, just as a sort of uh-oh kind of moment.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is one of the best hidden bombs that Dance with Dragons has left us. The impact of grayscale, because you only pick it up upon rereads of a Dance with Dragons that this sickness is featured quite prominently. And it is not entirely clear why. And if you look at Connington being perhaps patient zero, as you phrase it, that is a really frightening aspect of it.
Yeah.
And potentially devastating, especially in regards to the dragons that at some point will arrive in Westeros.
Yeah.
So there are many things that are to be discussed here once we get further information, and that's why I think Arianne 2 or at latest Arianne 3 of the Winds of Winter will be one of the most interesting chapters of the Doran storyline in and of itself. I also think, while we are talking about dragons here, that the thoughts on Daenerys are a very interesting thing that Arianne displays here, because she thinks about whether Daenerys has gone mad. Her reasoning is she watched her brother die. Now, we know you don't have to be mad just to watch Viserys die, but she can't know that. But given the ending of A Dance with Dragons, I think the question gains some importance, some relevance, because Daenerys might very well be mad, and we as readers don't know it yet.
Yeah, and I think things will shake down very differently. The Daenerys prior to her disappearance with Drogon is going to be very different than the Daenerys following her disappearance with Drogon. I mean, I tend to lean towards the idea that we're not going to see a sort of mad and monstrous Daenerys. You know, I think she'll maybe dance up close to that edge. It just doesn't feel right to me that suddenly she'll be this, like, crazy killing machine. But there's going to be a big change, and it's worth considering the way they're considering, because a lot rides on how predictable and rational her behavior is going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think that this quote from the Saivas game is very interesting. You have other pieces beside the dragon.
Right.
I wonder if this quote will be prophetic. It is just a throwaway line now, one that lets you smile, but I think it will gain some prophetic quality to it. Yes. In the course of the story as it develops.
Well, it's worth remembering that the final volume of the series was, for the long time, it intended to be called A Time for Wolves, which has nothing to do with dragons. And, you know, there's one wolf that we know of that we suspect of also being a dragon, a sort of wolf-dragon hybrid. But there are a lot of other wolves that aren't. And, you know, they all still have a part to play. So it's not all going to come down to Aegon and Daenerys and the other potential Targaryens, secret Targaryens, heads of the dragon, whatever you want to call it, or even the dragons, the literal dragons. You know, there are going to be other players, and Grayscale is a great example of that. You know, my hunch about Grayscale is that it's a way to take the extreme south off the Saivas table. You know, because the snows of winter can probably only reach so far south, even with supernatural power behind them, in a limited time frame. I'm not sure you're going to see, you know, the water gardens freeze over, but you could see a grayscale epidemic ravage that whole part of the world while the winter and the others are coming down from the north. That's just my thinking about it. You know, but there's more. Yeah, there's more pieces than just the dragon. Absolutely.
Yeah, I didn't know that the final volume was to be called The Time for Wolves. Yeah. That's an interesting detail.
Yeah.
I just have two minor details left from the chapter. The one is that we now finally know what Orane Waters is up to, so we can dismiss all theories that he has joined Stannis, which yeah. I always found preposterous to think.
Yeah.
But, okay, he is obviously Lord of the Waters, the pirate king of the Stepstones, which I find a very interesting thing. And I always have to laugh about Cersei whenever I hear the name Orane Waters. And then, of course, we have heard that the Rainwood and the Stepstones both have fallen in Cape Wrath and Tarth. So the homes of Davos and of Rhaen are both conquered by Aegon. And yes. I wonder whether this will have any impact on the story at all. What do you think?
Well, it's you know, I think Brienne's prospects of getting down there to do something about it are a little more reasonable than Davos's, simply because of where they're located geographically. And, you know, and their sort of mission, what their missions might be following the immediate resolution of their upcoming storylines, which in Davos's case is trying to find Rickon in Skagos, and in Brienne's case is just trying to, I guess, survive her entanglement with Lady Stoneheart. So, you know, I don't know, but I do think it's cool. To see the Aegon storyline potentially tying into these other storylines that I never would have expected to have any connection to Aegon and John Connington at all. You know, I mean, I guess I should have when I looked at the geography of where they were headed, but, you know, linking Davos and Brienne to John Connington and Aegon, it's just not something I saw coming. And, you know, one of these things these books do really well is, you know, kind of forge these connections that you don't see coming. You know, my friend, the blogger Kurt Purcell, described, you know, some examples of it as sort of this narrative shrapnel that ricochets, you know, throughout, across storylines, you know, that have, you know, these characters just sort of bounce in directions you never would have expected and do interesting things when they arrive there. And so, you know, it's just whether or not it plays out in such a way that, like, Davos has to come liberate his poor family from, you know, I kind of doubt that, but it's just cool to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't have anything further to add, so... If it is fine with you, we can end our boiled leather audio hour at this note.
That sounds good to me. Thank you everybody for listening. And you know, with any luck, I feel like George R. R. Martin. I'm hesitant to even say this, but I think it's possible that we may be able to record these a little more frequently from now on. I mean, you know, don't hold me to that because, you know, as I've said a million times, it's just it's difficult for us to coordinate across an ocean and a continent, and you know, with two babies running around, and you know, but we're going to do our best, and you know, there's certainly, it seems like there's sort of been a bit of a burst of activity. You know, and perhaps in future podcasts, we'll be able to tackle some of the other forthcoming developments in the world of Ice and Fire, which I'm excited to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. So thanks for listening. Mm-hmm. And until the next time, which will hopefully be soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.